Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Revolution Health Radio Show. This show is brought to you by ChrisKresser.com, and I'm your host, Steve Wright from SCDLifestyle.com. Now with me is integrative medical practitioner and healthy skeptic, Chris Kresser. So Chris, how's your day going?
It's great. Another beautiful day here in California, and really busy these days finishing up the book, which is exciting but time consuming. And I'm really excited about our guest today. His name's Dr. Sanjay Schwag, and he is a functional medicine physician out here in California that specializes in the treatment of Lyme disease, which we've talked about a few times but haven't covered in depth. So Sanjay's become also a friend lately, and we've had a number of conversations about it personally, and so I thought it would be great to bring him on the show to get the perspective of someone who's kind of on the ground treating Lyme on a daily basis. And so we're going to introduce him here in a second, just after the intro.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited because I have a number of really close friends who've been affected by Lyme's disease, and so I've seen the devastation that it can cause firsthand. And so I'm excited for this show, and I also just want to let the listeners know that I'm coming to you live right now from Jordan's closet in Montana. So I'm joining you, Chris, with recording in a closet for the first time.
Awesome.
So if the sound quality is a little off this week, or if it's a little better, I guess we're going to learn something from this show. Okay, so before we bring on the doctor, I just want to tell everybody who's listening to the show, if this is your first time listening to the Revolution Health Radio Show, you're probably going to want to check out what over 30,000 other people have already signed up for. It's Chris's 13-part free email series called Beyond Paleo. Now, this email series is Chris's best tips and tricks for burning fat, boosting energy, and preventing and reversing disease without drugs. So if this sounds cool, go over to ChrisKresser.com, look for the big red box, and go ahead and put your name and email in that box. And when you sign up, Chris is going to start sending you those emails right away this week. Okay, Chris, are we ready to bring on our guest?
Let's do it. Okay, everyone. So I'd like to introduce Sanjay Schwag. He's a functional medicine physician here in Northern California, and we're excited to have him on the show to talk to us a little bit about Lyme disease, which is, as we've discussed before, a very controversial topic. But before we do that, Sanjay, maybe you could just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background, how you got interested in functional medicine, and in particular, how you got involved in treating Lyme disease.
Sure. Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be here. And, you know, my journey into medicine, I was always pretty focused on practicing and learning complementary alternative integrative medicine, even from before I went to medical school. And so when I did enter med school at UC Irvine, I went there specifically because they actually had a growing integrative medicine program. And so it was pretty active during medical school with integrative medicine education and designing and leading courses, and followed that through into residency when I went to the UCSF Santa Rosa Family Practice Program. I knew the whole time that I really pretty much had to end up practicing integrative medicine, otherwise I wasn't going to last. And, just from everything I'd experienced in my, you know, growing up and prior life experience told me that that was the best way to do it. And, you know, combine the integrative alternative side with a good solid Western science background really made sense too. And so through residency, I continued, you know, to do the allopathic Western medicine route. But whenever I could, I would do electives in integrative medicine and go and precept or shadow integrative doctors in the area, go to conferences, you know, do, you know, reading, whatever I could figure out to bring it all together. And then as soon as I finished residency, I jumped right into working in integrative medicine practice up in Sonoma County, which I've been doing ever since. And originally, a big part of what got me into looking at and working with Lyme disease was when my wife was diagnosed with it. And in addition, you know, about 6 or 8 months later, we also found out that my stepmother also had Lyme. And watching them go through, their treatment courses with this really pushed me to dive pretty deeply into the research and into the information behind all of it.
Mm-hmm. So let's just dive in and start talking about this crazy thing called Lyme disease. As you and I have discussed, Sanjay, you know, there's a wide, and as we've talked about on the show, there's really a broad spectrum of perspectives on Lyme disease. And on the one end of the extreme, you have perhaps the CDC perspective that chronic Lyme is a myth and doesn't exist, and there's just an acute infection that happens with Lyme disease, and then maybe sort of they recognize that some people with acute Lyme may have chronic symptoms, but they don't believe that it's associated with a continuing Lyme infection. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have some people, primarily you'll find them on the internet claiming that nearly everyone has chronic Lyme, or just about any symptom that someone might experience is due to chronic Lyme, and it's become a little bit of a fad diagnosis in a way. So let's maybe just start from the beginning and talk a little bit about what Lyme is, and maybe explore it as an organism, and just talk about some basics on Lyme, and then we can go into this controversy in a little bit more detail.
Sure. Yeah, that sounds good. And I think you have it as a good frame. The degree and depth of the controversy that exists in this country is fairly staggering on both sides. So I think that's definitely a good topic of discussion. What is Lyme disease? In a very specific sense, if we're talking about Lyme disease, it refers specifically to a bacteria called Borrelia burgdorferi, which is a spirochete bacteria and is transmitted by tick bite. And if you go further into the controversial end of things, there's discussion about other modes of transmission. But the best documented, the best known route of transmission is by a tick bite, and usually it's the black-legged tick, whether it's the Ixodes scapularis or the Ixodes pacificus. The scapularis is on the East Coast more, and the pacificus is out here on the West Coast.
Yeah, literally right outside of my door.
Yeah.
As we discovered the other day, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Technically Lyme disease refers to the infection with that one spirochete bacteria and its possible sequelae. And what's not controversial is that people can get bitten by a tick, they can have transmission of this bacteria, and they can become sick from it in the acute phase and cause fever, headaches, malaise, flu-like symptoms, migratory joint pain. Pain that starts in one knee and then moves to one shoulder and then moves to an elbow and then to a hand or an ankle. There's very few other things that do that other than Lyme disease. Mm-hmm. And where we'll talk more, I'm sure, but where the controversy sort of builds is as to whether this bacteria could potentially be passed to somebody and then not necessarily cause a big acute symptom picture, but instead lay dormant, and then at some time point in the future, and that time point, depending on who you talk to, could be anywhere from a few weeks to a few months, up to 10 or 15 years, it might sort of rear its head and start causing symptoms. The name Lyme disease comes from Lyme, Connecticut, where this syndrome or this disease was first "quote unquote" discovered, mm-hmm. by the advocacy and insistence of parents back there who realized in the late 70s and early 80s that there was just way too many people and way too many kids who had this illness. And so by their persistence and demanding and cajoling, they managed to get investigation of that with the CDC and various rheumatologists, and this was sort of "quote unquote" discovered. I'm using that with quotes because there's a lot of history behind that actually contributes to the controversy that we see now. But we can get into that in a little bit. So that specifically Lyme disease is this one bacteria, but I think in a broader sense, you know, in a societal way, it's used to kind of talk about something a little or quite a bit broader, which mm-hmm. is this general, you know, illness syndrome, which also can include what we call co-infections, which are other bacteria or parasites that could possibly have been passed along with that tick bite. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, there are many. Ticks are pretty much laden with a bunch of different pathogens. So there's those specific infections, which can be tricky to diagnose properly. And then there's sort of this more kind of global, decrease of function. You know, does it contribute to illnesses like chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia? There's also, when you have some of these infections, it can really take your immune system offline in a lot of significant ways. And there's some pretty severe increases of autoimmune activation that can occur. And there's discussion, as to whether it's also contributing to some pretty major illnesses in our society, such as MS or ALS or maybe even Parkinson's. There's a pretty well-known researcher who's highly reputable, who's shown that in a fairly high percentage of Alzheimer's patients, you can isolate the Borrelia burgdorferi spirochete from the amyloid plaque lesions in their brains. And mm-hmm. so there's kind of a pretty big web that this thing might be casting, and it gets really difficult to tease out, like you mentioned, what's real, what's going on, and what's the actual scope of this issue.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, it's really, they're really, just to emphasize this again, there really is no part of this discussion that isn't controversial, whether yeah. you're talking about the diagnostic procedures, which we can get into in a little bit, whether you're talking about the symptoms and then the co-infections and diagnosing them and what they're capable of causing, and
right.
and whether Lyme is increasing in prevalence. And I mean, it's really just a remarkably polarized issue that it gets incredibly heated and almost like violent types of disagreement, which is unfortunate because patients or, just the general public are the people who really suffer from that, because who are just trying to get some information, and learn about a condition that they feel like they might be affected by. But let's maybe talk a little bit about diagnosis as that will, I think, serve as a doorway into some of this controversy. What are the tests as a clinician that you rely on to diagnose Lyme disease, and then how does that differ from, say, the criteria that the CDC lay out for diagnosing Lyme? And then maybe we can talk a little bit about some of the newer tests that are becoming available, and what some of the issues with those are.
Sure. Yeah, sounds good. So I'm actually going to turn that around. I want to talk first about the sort of mainstream CDC criteria and mm-hmm. diagnostic recommendations as a starting point, and then I'll kind of jump off into some of the ways that's not ideal, and then some mm-hmm. of the stuff that we're using. But basically, if you go to your regular doctor and you have a documented tick bite, and let's say you even have the bullseye rash, which is stereotypical, which does not happen in all patients. It probably only happens in about maybe 30-50%. So mm-hmm. if you go in and there's a suspicion for Lyme and your doctor agrees to test you, the recommended testing is what's called a two-tiered test, which means that they run what's called an ELISA antibody test first. And then only if that's positive does the test reflex over to do what's called a Western blot test. And if you look at the research literature on this methodology, unfortunately, the false negative rate is anywhere from 33 to 75% by that two-tiered testing criteria. And there's a number of reasons for that. On the one hand, you know, a certain percentage of people are lucky enough to mount a robust antibody response, and then that shows up on the blood test. Mm-hmm. A significant amount of people are not. And it also has been shown that the longer you're sick with this and the longer it's been since you were actually exposed, you're actually less likely to show an antibody response because of the way the bacteria can evade the immune system. These are what are called stealth pathogens, and they're actually remarkably well designed to persist and to hide from the immune system. And so after a while, your body kind of gives up and stops making antibodies. Mm-hmm. And the corollary of that is actually when you treat somebody and you test them after you've been treating them, frequently their tests will turn positive as the immune system sees the bacteria again. So, you know, so the two-tier testing has a pretty high false negative rate. And then, you know, if you do sort of make it through the first gate and you have a positive ELISA and then you do the Western blot, the CDC has set up this criteria wherein certain antibodies that you're making are considered specific and certain other ones are not. And they require that you have a certain pattern and a specific number of these different antibodies in order to qualify for a positive test. And there's a lot of controversy about, you know, sort of which ones they chose and which ones mm-hmm. they excluded. Back in the 80s, they had developed a Lyme vaccine, and as a result, and which has been since taken off the market because of some fairly severe side effects that people were developing. But they changed the test once they did that, and they excluded certain bands which would have been positive as a result of the vaccine. And
were highly specific to Lyme, those particular bands.
Mm-hmm. Right, very specific to Lyme. And the other problem with the test is that there's one kit that's used that has been approved by the FDA and the CDC, and that kit has one strain of the bacteria, and it is the Lyme Connecticut strain. And what we're seeing worldwide, there's probably over 300 different strains of this bacteria. And some really interesting cutting edge research that's coming out of California is we're seeing, what were thought to be only European strains, we're seeing them showing up here. So Borrelia besseti, Borrelia myomatoi, and there's all sorts of other Borrelia bacteria, like Borrelia hermsii, which causes more of a tick-borne relapsing fever picture, which we're seeing if we know to look for them. However, that one test kit is not going to pick those up because those antibodies are different. And so there's a number of reasons why, the testing is problematic.
Most of which the CDC does not acknowledge. From their perspective, their testing is accurate. From what I've seen, they don't really admit to many of these deficiencies.
They don't admit to it publicly, but there is actually a fairly robust behind-the-scenes discussion going on. Mm-hmm. You know, it's pretty widely recognized that that the testing is inadequate, and I think most scientists agree with that. But what to do about it is controversial. You know, the data that's coming out about these other forms of Borrelia is pretty good, hard science, and they're not disputing that. And so I think what they're trying to do is just figure out what do we do about it. Mm-hmm. but no, there's actually a pretty, both myself and my wife, Leah, were fairly deeply involved with Lyme research and Lyme advocacy. And there's just some actually very, very exciting movement going on in the field right now where we're seeing a real big upsurge in the last year and a half or so in people who either have funding or have access to funding or have connections in the scientific world. And we're starting to see this real push towards trying to build a better diagnostic and trying to build better treatment protocols. So there's definitely some exciting movement, but we're really playing catch up. And mm-hmm. you know, it's gonna definitely be kind of a trickle down situation where, I mean, the level of disinformation that exists in the mainstream medical community is fairly shocking. And I still get a lot of people who come to me and say, well, you know, my doctor said we don't have Lyme in California, so I couldn't have Lyme.
Right.
Just like, I mean, if you go to the California Department of Public Health, the statistics are super, super clear on the prevalence, you know, with, you know, the Ixodes pacificus tick being found in 56 out of 58 of California counties, mm-hmm. and ticks testing positive for Borrelia burgdorferi in, you know, 42 out of 58 of the counties. And when they do tick sweeps, they're showing, you know, actual infection of those ticks at a rate of anywhere from, you know, 1% up to sometimes as high as 33 or even 41% in some areas of Mendocino County.
That is truly frightening.
Yes, I agree.
I mean, it's really a public health, a really serious issue for people living in those places. And you know this better than I do, since you treat people regularly who are suffering from Lyme disease. But it's not something, I mean, within the Lyme community, it's something that's talked about a lot, of course. But outside of the Lyme community, I don't think very many people are aware that, you know, they go on a walk in a place like Mendocino and they get bitten by a tick. There's that level of risk that tick could transmit Lyme disease.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's also, you know, that's absolutely accurate. And there's also, you know, some misinformation in terms of what it actually takes for a tick to transmit the bacteria. The standard, the standard information that we get from the Department of Public Health or the CDC is that the tick has to be attached for, you know, they say usually greater than 48 or 72 hours in order for it to transmit the bacteria. However, that data was off of some veterinary studies and doesn't necessarily apply the same way to humans. And I think it's kind of a bell curve. I think on average it might take that long. Especially if the tick hasn't fed in a long time and all the bacteria is kind of hiding out in its hind gut. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if a tick has fed more recently, or, you know, in circumstances we don't quite understand yet, I've seen, you know, for example, a patient of mine who came in, he had gone kayaking. He hiked in with his kayak at 9 in the morning. He hiked out at 6 p.m., and in the shower that night, he found a tick and he removed it and he developed a bullseye rash and Lyme symptoms. You know, so that's a tick attachment of about 8 hours.
Wow.
So, yeah, there's a lot of misinformation, but we're working on that.
Mm-hmm. So there's the two-tier criteria and all the issues with that. And particularly important, I think, is the message that you don't necessarily need to have a bullseye rash and really at least 50% and often and possibly a majority of cases people won't have that rash. So that's something to be aware of. If you get a tick bite, you don't necessarily need to have that rash to develop Lyme. So let's talk now about some of the other options for diagnosis that, you know, outside of the two-tier tests and what you're relying on these days in your practice.
Yeah, sure. And then one last closing thought on the two-tier test. You know, there's some good legislation that's coming out, particularly in the East Coast, like Virginia and Massachusetts. And in Virginia, they're actually in the process of passing a law. It might have already gone through, but they're basically saying that, you know, every time someone's tested for Lyme disease, that they need to have on that piece of paper that the lab comes back on, the piece of information that says that, you know, the testing is not perfect and that if you are symptomatic, you could possibly have Lyme disease even with a negative test. So that's a kind of a cool step forward.
Yeah.
You know, but what we're looking at again is that if there's any antibodies on that test and the person has symptoms, that it's possible that that's part of what's going on for them. You know, so what we do in our practice is, you know, I always do my best to see if I can find laboratory evidence of these infections through the most mainstream and well-accepted lab possible, so that there's, you know, less of a chance that, you know, other doctors could say it's not real. So I'll run, you know, the testing through the regular labs, and if something's showing up, then and the person's symptomatic, then we'll talk about treatment options. And if we feel like we need other testing avenues, there's a number of different directions to go. You know, there's specialty laboratories like Igenix, which I will use. However, I do find myself using it less and less, given that there is a fair amount of controversy, and a lot of doctors, you know, again, like to just say that, you know, Igenix calls everything positive, so we're not going to believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a test called a CD57 cell count, which is a white blood cell marker. You know, the CD is stands for cluster of differentiation. It's basically just a flag on the surface of the cell where we can identify them and sort them. And there's been some discussion in the literature about this one subset being low in people who have persistent or chronic Lyme disease. And you know, I'm finding that to be helpful, but not totally diagnostic. It's I think it can also be low with chronic viral infections.
Right, like HIV and some others, huh?
Yeah, HIV, it may be HHV6, maybe mycoplasma. So there's a number of possible causes.
And perhaps others that we don't know about yet.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
so I use it more of like, does it put someone in this ballpark of this kind of illness cluster?
Mm-hmm.
And then the newest test, which has been available, is a blood culture, which I think we should definitely talk about. And so blood culture for Borrelia species, and what they do basically is, draw the patient's blood sample, send it back to the lab, and they look at the result. They put it in an incubator. They enrich it with a 12% rabbit serum, which is higher potential for growing the bacteria. And then they put it into a long-term culture for anywhere from 8 to 16 weeks, because what has been shown is that the Borrelia bacteria are very, very slow growing, which is part of why the treatments take so long, because they are best treated when they're actively replicating. So on average, they probably replicate once a month, and this is, you know, totally different than quote unquote normal bacterial infections. So the Borrelia culture test, you know, has been really helpful. It's really new. We're still trying to figure out in my practice, you know, what are the chances we're just getting false positives, or, you know, even more interestingly, you know, what are the chances that many people, if not most people, have been exposed at some point and might have some of these bacteria in their system, and yet it's not either A, causing them symptoms, or not B, the main driver of their symptoms. And so that's sort of, you know, goes into the whole old friends discussion and what can we handle and not handle. But, you know, I think on the face of it, we really should not have any Borrelia bacteria growing in our bloodstream. And what we're kind of looking for at this point with the lab is we're waiting for independent verification and for other universities and other laboratories to be able to repeat their initial studies and results as they were validating the test, and to show that, you know, there's no reason for us to be concerned about false positives, that there could be some kind of cross-contamination or other reasons. But at this point, it has been a very helpful test for our practice, because, you know, it does, it has been able to show growth of these bacteria when the antibody tests are not picking it up.
Just curious, have you had any situations where antibody tests have been positive and the culture has been negative?
I have, yes. Mm-hmm. And what we always have to do is this kind of dance of, you know, well, what are the symptoms? What's, you know, it becomes a kind of an exchange of information between the patient's picture, the symptom picture that they bring in, the lab testing, the results of the various tests we do. Mm-hmm. And then if we're still, not sure, what I will generally guide people into is some, provocation treatments. And initially, I always prefer to do those with herbs because there's just generally less side effects. And what we look at then, we have these targeted herbs or even targeted formulas against either Lyme or Babesia or Bartonella, et cetera, some of the co-infections. And we're looking for, is there any, aggravation response? Is there any flare-up reaction which could indicate that there is a hidden infection? Mm-hmm. And so, it's kind of like working in smoke and mirrors land. You have to really feel your way along. One of my mentors, said that it's kind of like we've just been dropped into the jungle and we have no map and we have no sense of direction. And we get information from each step that we take and the response to that step.
Mm-hmm. And complicating things further. I mean, there are some symptoms that are typically a red flag for Lyme, but most of the symptoms of Lyme are nonspecific, which means they could be associated with any number of other things. And of course, that makes it really difficult for the patient and difficult for the clinicians. I think the culture test is really promising, and it's kind of a fascinating microcosm of the macrocosm of controversy that exists around Lyme, because the research that's been done so far has been done by scientists who actually work at the laboratory, which in itself, the laboratory that does the test and the company that sells the test, and that in itself doesn't invalidate the research at all, but it does, at least in the scientific community, it raises some eyebrows and it makes us think, okay, well, this is a promising result, and now that they've published their methods in a recent paper, peer-reviewed journal, not a very well-known journal, but their methods are now out there, and like you said, other scientists can try to reproduce those methods and see if they get the same results, and that's how the scientific method works, and that's really what we need to do in order to look at, treat this as a reliable test. But it's exciting, I'm sure, for you, and I'm only peripherally involved in Lyme. I have patients with Lyme. I don't specialize in treating it. But the difference with this test, of course, is all of the other, the other tests are sort of indirect. They're looking for antibodies in case of the, the ELISA and the Western blot, and of course it's possible that someone could have been exposed to Lyme before and it's not a current issue for them. Or in the case of the CD57, it's even less direct because it's just looking at a marker of immune function, which could be impaired by some things that we do know and other things that we don't know about. So, but the culture is a direct, they're actually culturing the organism in the blood. So if it turns out to be a reliable test, seems to me that would be a game changer in Lyme diagnosis.
Yeah, we're very hopeful. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, there's a number of other efforts underway. There's some researchers at Johns Hopkins. There's some folks at Stanford and UCSF. And mind you, these are all on the research side. So, if you go and talk to the clinical physicians, you're going to still get the party line. But we're starting to get these pockets of researchers who are willing to look at this thing. And, for example, at Johns Hopkins, they're building what's called a biorepository where, for right now, they're only using documented EM rash positive Lyme disease patients. So, and they take pictures of the rashes, they measure the rash, and so there's no dispute that these people have Lyme. Mm-hmm. And then what they're doing is they're doing a baseline and then serial blood samples, collecting these folks' blood and going out in time. And what we're hoping is that we can kind of develop biomarkers of this illness and of people with acute illness and then people who get better and then people who don't get better, people who have residual symptoms, and try to figure out what's different and how we can develop new tests.
So Sanja, we've talked about some really cool new testing that's coming up, and we've also talked about the older and first forms of the ELISA testing and stuff for Lyme. So for someone who's listening to this, it's 2013 right now as we record this, what would you give them as far as what they should be asking or talking with their practitioner to cover all their bases to try to figure out if they did get infected?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And, you know, I would really recommend that if people are sick and they have these kind of nondescript, chronic, fairly debilitating illnesses, that, you know, the classic story is that people have gone from doctor to doctor to doctor over a number of years and haven't, you know, been diagnosed with anything wrong other than maybe they should go see a psychiatrist. And in those cases, you know, if they've never been tested for Lyme disease and co-infections, you know, whatever they can do to get to a doctor who's willing to test those would be really important. And, you know, if they can get it through their regular primary care doctor, you know, it's definitely worth doing the Lyme ELISA and Western blot, as well as antibody testing for some of the more common co-infections like Bartonella and Babesia and Ehrlichia, as well as viruses like Epstein-Barr and HHV6. So, you know, some of those you can get done. CD57 cell count, that's another good one. Some of these you can get done through your regular doctor if they're sympathetic and willing to run them. And if not, then, you know, pretty much people have to find their way to a Lyme literate practitioner who has the knowledge and how to interpret these tests and the willingness to order them.
Right. Yeah, I just want to jump in and say there are some conditions we talk a lot about, kind of DIY self-treatment options, and there are many that can be safely done, you know, with some caveats, of course. But Lyme is so potentially serious and so, you know, such a changing landscape and so controversial, and there's so many things to consider, that if it's at all possible, I think finding a physician or healthcare, other kind of healthcare practitioner that is very current and specializes in the diagnosis and treatment of Lyme is a really important first step to take. It's you know, personally, that's always my recommendation to people, and it's not something that I would really mess around much with, because a lot of general care practitioners aren't really current with this stuff. They're not following. They don't know what tests to run. They don't know how to interpret the tests, even if you tell them what tests to run. And so it's not always possible or easy to find a Lyme practitioner. But Sanjay, you know, what can people do what resources are out there in terms of online directories, or how would you recommend that people go about doing that?
Yeah, so there's a couple of good organizations that are working to you know, build the science and improve education around this. One of the first ones is called ILADS, ILADS. It stands for the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society. And they have a directory of physicians. There's also in the Bay Area a group called the Bay Area Lyme Foundation, who are newer to the scene, but really quite instrumental at this point in improving education. And they would have access to, you know, some physician information. On the East Coast, there's the Tick-Borne Disease Alliance. They would also be a helpful group. You know, so there's a number of good organizations who have lists of practitioners who can look at this thing.
So, you know, we could probably do about 40 podcasts on Lyme disease and still have a lot to talk about, right? And I know there are some people out there who are, you know, maybe hoping for a much more in-depth discussion on certain points. The idea here was to give a basic overview of the landscape. And in that spirit, since we've talked a little bit about the controversy and a little bit about diagnosis, I'd like to at least discuss a little bit of prevention and treatment. I mean, obviously we're not going to be able to go into great detail about treatment, but maybe we could just talk about the range of options, what you've found, what you're focusing on now in your practice, and then the kind of strategies that you use with, you know, yourself and your family, and what you recommend to patients in terms of prevention in areas where Lyme is endemic, like, you know, in our neighborhood, for example, right up here in Tilden Park, there's a fairly high incidence of I haven't seen recent statistics, but I remember reading something that they're, you know, a fairly significant percentage of the ticks in the Tilden area carry Lyme.
Yeah, I would probably say it's probably in the 7 to 12% range. And interestingly, you know, and this is a little spooky, but you know, the ticks are really, they really vary in size. So in terms of prevention, it can be actually kind of hard to spot them. And the nymphs, the baby ones, are about the size of a poppy seed. And unfortunately, those are the ones which have the highest rate of carrying the bacteria. Mm-hmm. And on the West Coast out here, that's due to the fact that we have the Western fence lizard. And as ticks grow from baby to adult, they have spent more time feeding on these Western fence lizards. And for some reason, there's a complement protein in the blood of these lizards that actually cleans out the Borrelia burgdorferi bacteria. So adult ticks that we're more likely to see have a less decreased rate of carrying the bacteria and less risk of passing it. And it's the little baby poppy seed sized ones that we are actually fairly unlikely to find on ourselves that have the higher rates of carriage, again, up into the, you know, depending on the geographic area, but as high as 30 or maybe even 40%. And that lizard is actually part of why there's less Lyme here than there is on the East Coast, because they mm-hmm. don't have that lizard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, are there any, you know, you often hear of tick repellents, like both the kind of conventional types and then the maybe like we could call them the hippie versions with essential oils and coconut right. oil and things like that. Do you have any thoughts about that, those and their effectiveness?
You know, there's not a lot of data on them. You know, I think that anecdotally there might be some sense that they can help. DEET, you know, the pretty hardcore DEET is, mm-hmm. it is effective. It's just a question of who really wants to put that on themselves or their kids.
Right.
You know, probably the most, you know, effective way to prevent it is just to, you know, I still love hiking. It's important to be out in nature. And, you know, the thing that we try to do now is, you know, wear long pants, tuck your pants into your socks. And when you get home, and try not to, you know, sit in under the oak trees in the leaf litter. That's a you know, high area where the ticks tend to hang out. And, you know, when you get home, you take your clothes off, you put your clothes in the dryer for 30 minutes and you take a shower.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably one of the best ways to prevent tick attachment. And then being aware of, you know, the fact that the ticks tend to crawl up onto the grass blades and hang out along the edges of paths. So, you know, wider paths are definitely better. The smaller single track paths will have, you know, a higher risk of ticks kind of hitching a ride on you.
How about time of year?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's possible that you could be exposed and bitten by a tick carrying Lyme disease any time of the year, particularly out here in California. It takes a pretty deep freeze for pretty long and deep freeze for them to go into hibernation. Now, that being said, there's definitely a higher risk in the early spring through early summer months. Mm-hmm. And that sort of plateaus by the middle of summer and starts to taper through the fall. You know, so it's higher risk during those months, but it is possible any time of year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so treatment. There obviously are a number of options here, and of course the controversy doesn't stop here either. That we've got everything from high dose multiple oral antibiotics to intravenous antibiotics to things like the Buhner protocol, you know, various herbal treatments to Rife to you know, any number of things. So given that we can't discuss all of them, maybe we should just focus on the ones that you are using most in your practice now and you think are the most effective and promising.
Yeah. So, you know, I divide the field into a couple of major compartments, and, you know, on one side, there's most of mainstream medicine who does not think that these chronic infections exist. And on the other side are practitioners like myself, which, you know, fortunately there are more and more of these days. There's more folks being trained and there's more awareness. So it's slowly growing. So there's this, you know, there's this group of people who do think that this thing exists and that we have to try to find it and understand whether or not people are sick with this. And then we have, if they are, we have to find a way to treat it. And within that group, which is the most interesting group to me, you know, within that group, there's a wide range of thoughts on how to do it. You know, on the more extreme end, there are the practitioners who think that you have to treat with, you know, 3 to 4, sometimes 5 different antibiotics at a time. And, you know, there's science-based reasons why some folks believe this, that which is that the bacteria can exist in different compartments and it can kind of respond to the pressure of the antibiotic treatment and go from being in the bloodstream to hiding inside of the cells or kind of hunker down into a cyst form, and that no one antibiotic covers all of those forms. And so you have to, you know, use multiple antibiotics, try to catch it as it shifts from one form to the other. So, and then there's the folks on the other end of the treatment spectrum who think that, you know, antibiotics don't really work, that we should be doing, you know, infrared sauna, salt and vitamin C protocols, Rife machine, energetic medicine, et cetera. And I'm somewhere in the middle. I use a lot of antibiotics. I try to use them judiciously, but I've done them enough now that I have seen a significant group of people who really, really are helped by it and who get better and stay better. And at the same time, there's a group of people who either can't tolerate them or who just seem to be getting sicker when we're doing those kinds of treatments. And to me, it feels like, you know, there's something else going on.
Sanjay, when you say antibiotics, are you referring to oral or intravenous or both?
Yeah, mostly I focus when I'm using Western medicine antibiotics, because they're also herbal antibiotics. But mm-hmm. when I'm using Western medicine antibiotics, I'm usually using oral. I also actually found that intramuscular shots, like something like bicillin, is actually really helpful because it mm-hmm. bypasses the gut.
Yeah,
And in some cases I will use IV, although it's it brings up a new set of risks.
Right.
You know, and you know, to be honest with you, getting into this world, you know, is always kind of been a little bit of a struggle because you know, I came at it from a really integrative, complementary, alternative medicine point of view, which is that I wanted to get away from antibiotics. I wanted to, you know, really, you know, do my best to respect the gut and the gut immune system and the gut ecology and the microbiome, you know. So I frequently find myself kind of caught where I see these treatments helping, but on the other hand, I also am always concerned and aware of the risks to the human organism as a whole. You know, so I will also be rotating in a variety of different herbal protocols, whether it's some of the Buhner, Stephen Buhner herbs. He has a couple of really good books out, mm-hmm. very, very well-researched scientific works on the actions of some of these herbal antibiotics. I also use a lot of Byron White formulas, some really great herbal protocols and products, as well as there's a woman named Susan McCamish who has a group of products that are really helpful. And, you know, the thing that I think I would also recommend to folks is that if they find themselves in this world, that it really helps to work with a functional medicine or integrative medicine doctor, because it's so complicated. And some of the symptoms that people experience are due to direct infection, but a big group of the symptoms are just due to various body systems kind of going offline as a result of the infections. And so hormone balancing, adrenal balancing, you know, healing and testing the gut, you know, organic acids, all these aspects, you know, from dietary manipulation, you know, gluten-free, dairy-free, grain-free, paleo, body ecology. I mean, these are things that I discuss with people on a daily basis, trying to, you know, balance balance some of the more aggressive treatments that we're doing. And, you know, and like, you know, Chris and I, we've had some discussions about this in the last few weeks, but, you know, things as basic as stress management and optimizing exercise and sleep patterns and, you know, doing Qigong or acupuncture or biofeedback, you know, they're all really, it kind of gets to the point where in order to get through this, you have to really dial in every aspect of your life and get everything kind of playing together like a symphony.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, I mean, I treat a lot of patients with chronic illness. Some have Lyme, but most don't. But even that is, as you know, Sanjay, that the real trick in that kind of treatment is figuring out what to focus on, how to prioritize, what to prioritize, and how to get all the systems of the body communicating well with each other and, right. and working in harmony. And right. that's not always an easy process. And I imagine with and a few patients that I have with Lyme, it can get extremely convoluted because it's never easy to tell what's directly being caused by the infectious process and what's being caused by, you know, an immune reaction that is sort of secondary to that infection, and it can get really messy. So I completely agree. Finding someone who's well-versed in functional medicine and in particular who has experience dealing with these really complex conditions is important. And I know that is easier said than done. Some people live in areas where there aren't practitioners like this nearby, or if there are, they have a long wait list or what have you. But it definitely pays off to do a little bit of research and try to find someone that's compatible, even if you have to travel a little bit to see that person initially. Let's close by talking a little bit about resources. So you mentioned ILADS and some of the other websites before where people could find a practitioner. There's lots of books out there online. One of my favorites that I've read in the past few years is Cure Unknown by Pamela Weintraub. I'm curious to know what books you have found to be helpful for your patients.
Yeah, sure. Cure Unknown is definitely very high on my list. And Pamela Weintraub I'm not sure if she still is, but she was a science journalist for Discover magazine. Mm-hmm. And that book is just impeccably researched and has a great, you know, really, really strong notes and bibliography section. So yeah,
very well written and fascinating yeah. read too.
Yeah, super interesting, fast, engaging read. Mm-hmm. Another book I like a lot is a book called The Lyme Disease Solution by a doctor named Kenneth Singleton. Mm-hmm. He has a really nice kind of compilation of sort of just explaining, you know, the illness, the co-infections, all the symptoms associated with each. And he has some good sections on supplements and on diet. He calls it the Lyme inflammation diet, as well as, you know, stress management. So that's a good read. It's kind of like a handbook of, you know, sort of, you know, how to do this. Mm-hmm. There's a doctor back east whose name is Richard Horowitz, and I'm anxiously awaiting his book. He's coming out with a book pretty shortly, and he's a really, really, really smart guy who's been doing this for probably 20 years or so. So that would be a really good one. There's a movie called Under Our Skin, which is pretty well done. It's fairly dramatic. It's a documentary. So it, you know, it has some pretty severe cases in it, but I think it's a good representation of the controversy and the science. There's also a short film, 30-minute film, that you can find online by the Lyme Light Foundation about a professional skier back east and her journey with Lyme. So it's a kind of a little lighter and easier, more accessible. Mm-hmm. You know, with the Under Our Skin movie, I generally don't like my patients to see it until they're a lot better, just because I don't like people having scary negative images.
Yeah, that's a nocebo effect.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So Sanjay, how can people who are, you know, here in the Bay Area in California, or perhaps those who might be willing to travel to see you, find out more about your practice?
Yeah. So I have a website. It's www.drschweig.com. spelled D-R-S like Sam, C-H-W-E-I-G like George. And I'm currently practicing up in Sonoma County, and I'm probably going to moved part of that practice down to the East Bay. So stay tuned for information on possible new office. And then you can also, get in touch with Chris. You'll have my information if people want to find me.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Sanja, for coming back on the show. I have a strong suspicion that we're going to get some requests for a repeat visit because this is, you know, we just kind of scratched the surface of this topic, and it's a big one on a lot of people's minds. So hopefully we can get you back to do another show in the future.
Yeah, it would be my pleasure. It'd be fun to do a show on the gut and the whole microbiome with related to these illnesses, because I think that would be an interesting conversation.
Oh yeah, that's right up our alley for sure. So and maybe a little more on the discussion of old friends and how it might relate to
right.
to Lyme, because as you and I have talked about, I think that's a really fascinating potential avenue of exploration and something that's been on my mind, and then I'm speaking about at the Ancestral Health Symposium this year, provided I can finish my book in time and prepare the presentation. That's another story. So, thanks again, Sanja, for coming on, and hopefully we'll have you back on soon.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I kind of hear a series beginning here, so that was pretty awesome, Sanja.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this podcast. In between our Q&A episodes, we like to bring on great experts like you heard today, but we will be doing more Q&A episodes in the future. So if you'd like to submit your questions, please go over to chriskresser.com and use the podcast submission link. And if you love this podcast, if you want to hear more from Sanja, more from Chris, please go over to iTunes, leave us a review. Let us know in the comments section below in this post what you thought and what you'd like to hear on further shows. Thanks for listening.